Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inspiring Leadership Podcast, brought to you by Pursue Limited, coaching specialists with a mission to revolutionise professional development across the global education sector by harnessing the power and the potential of coaching. My name is Nicholas Mackay, professional certified coach and director of Pursue, and I'm going to be your host as we aim to bring you some of the best thinking in education and beyond, gaining insights into inspiring leadership. Many thanks for your engagement and feedback across the podcast platforms. And if you'd like to join the Pursue conversation, you can visit us on our website, pursue.com, LinkedIn and Twitter at Nicholas Mackay and Pursue. So let's get on with today's episode. And I'm delighted to welcome Emma Bateman, Chief Operating Officer of the Repton Schools Group. Emma's current role is responsible for all professional services and all operational support to the three UK schools and other group entities. Her role is also responsible for mergers and acquisitions and digital strategies. In addition, Emma is accountable for delivering group strategy, income and services through the Repton School Enterprises and Repton International Schools Limited. Emma joined Repton in 2019 from a broad commercial and corporate career, which began on a city trading floor. During her career, Emma has managed turnover ranging from £23 million to £500 million, the UK and global teams ranging from 85 to 12,000 people. Prior to her commercial career, Emma began life as an academic, studying for a PhD in American history, lecturing in American studies at Birmingham and Warwick universities. Emma, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you. Really pleased to be here, Nick.
So I've got to start, and we had a quick chat before I came on about that trading role, because as I mentioned to you, I've always got this thing in my mind about the Wolf of Wall Street. It's mayhem. You're on the trading floor. It's all go. It's chaos. Is that true?
Yes and no. So when I joined the trading floor, it was trading had just transitioned to fully electronic. So in the UK, I spent some time in the States. So in the UK, sadly, that kind of bear pit of people actually shouting at each other had gone. And it was people doing that in a more digital, electronic way. But it does still have that same frenetic nature. Hugely pressurized environment to work in. And I did get a couple of weeks over in Chicago on the border trade floor, which was proper open outcry. So people in jackets shouting at each other. Which was fascinating. It was really, really, really hard work, really good fun. And an interesting way to start my career, I suppose, particularly having previously been an academic. So I think when I joined the trading floor, I was the first woman they'd ever employed, and I was the first person they'd ever employed who had an arts degree. So I turned up like this proper weirdo. I really enjoyed it, actually. I'm still very good friends with a good number of the guys that I worked with, and it was a very powerful experience.
So I'm curious, what took you from, is it PhD in American history, onto the trading floor?
So I'm probably supposed to say, you know, that I have this really grand plan for my whole career, and everything I've ever done has gradually built to this moment. That would be an absolute lie.
I'm disappointed.
So I think so much of my career has been a series of happy accidents or coincidences or right people and place. So the academic to trading floor one happened. Oh, again, this probably sounds very unprofessional, because I was in a pub at a party in London, and I'd come to the end of my PhD. I was not really sure what I wanted to do next, but I think I knew that I didn't want to be an academic anymore. At a party, met somebody, having a chat with them over a glass of wine, and they said that they were recruiting for these roles in the city. And I was like, oh, that's a very interesting thing that you do, whatever. And I said, well, tell me a bit about it. And they said, this company is only looking for two things. They're looking for somebody, people who've got a first-class degree, so they're obviously, you know, vaguely smart, and people who've played sport to a high level. And I was like, I think that's a slightly odd set of recruitment criteria. But anyway, I was like, well, that's interesting, because I've got both of those things. So it went from there. So it was a complete accident of meeting a stranger in a pub who then introduced me to the headhunter, and I thought, oh, give it a go. And if I'm truly honest, I went, having spent, 7, 8 years studying university, I had quite a lot of debt. And I thought, this will probably be quite a good way to get rid of some of that quite quickly and not be saddled with it for the rest of my life. So, so that is the true and honest answer to your question. It was a bit of a happy accident and a pragmatic choice about paying back my student loans, which is probably, if I'm honest, why I did it for a few years, but it was likely never to be my life and my career. Mostly because I don't think I cared enough about earning loads of cash, which has to be your primary motivator. And if I'm honest, probably relate to that. I don't think I was actually that good at it. You know, I'm good enough. But I don't think, you know, was I the best trader or the best sales trader? Definitely not. But was it a brilliant thing to do? Yes, it was.
Sounds great. I love that story. And just to pick you up on that, so what is your primary motivator then, Emma?
Yeah, I was thinking about that before I came on, just in case you asked me. There's a few things, I think. And again, I think they've probably developed over time. But if I kind of answer that question in the now, I think one of my biggest drivers is curiosity. I'm just endlessly interested in anything and everything, even things that I'm sort of not really interested in or that aren't my thing, like all the sport that my husband is obsessed with. But I can still be sort of intellectually curious about all of it. So I'm really fascinated by the weird rules of cricket or by the way in which rugby league and rugby union differ, even though I don't really care about it. So I have a kind of an innate curiosity where I'm just interested in everything around me, like a almost, I suppose, in a childlike kind of way. And then I think it's something about, without this sounding grandiose, making a difference and leaving some kind of positive impact on other people, even if they don't realize it at the time. And again, I was kind of thinking, oh, making a difference, that sounds like I should go and run a charity and change the world. And I'm either too lazy to do that or not good enough or it's not my thing. But I think whatever you do, you can make a positive difference on the world of work and personal life that sits around you. And so I suppose I'm powered by that. Everything I've ever done has always been about something new or something that needs changing or remaking or reconfiguring in some way. I don't think I've ever really done a role where I've turned up and just looked after something and gone, just leave it how it is and just keep it going. It's always been about change. And it's always been about people. So I'm endlessly fascinated by each and every one of us and our idiosyncrasies and why we behave like we do. If I had my time again, I wonder if I should have or would have really enjoyed studying psychology, because I'm just really interested in why we all behave as we do and what drives us and what motivates us. So that's always been quite a big driver for me as well. It is fundamentally about people, which is why I think, although I love digital and tech, when I've done roles that are purely tech and digital, I find them quite challenging because there's not enough people. And I like people because they're kind of messy and complicated and they don't behave in rational ways, including me. You know, people make all kinds of decisions and choices that are motivated by emotion or... And that's what I find really interesting. And the things, so when I worked in e-commerce and things are very much more mechanical and A equals B equals C, that doesn't quite do it for me. Still an interesting discipline. And I like how people interact with technology. There's always been a big theme about people and just, again, being curious about each of us.
So I love that in terms of, you know, these big sort of themes coming through: people, change, curiosity. So again, I suppose in my curiosity, how do those relate to your current role? So maybe just take us through in a little bit about what you currently do.
Yeah, so I suppose a big part is that when Repton put this role together, both the role and the sort of definition of what they were looking for, it was a change gig. So the role was changed from the more traditional bursar to a chief operating officer. It was changed from being the senior school to being a whole through school and then a group of schools. And because of that, it was changed from being I suppose it, they wanted somebody much more commercial, more rounded, and a bit different. So I think that really appealed to me, because the I was joining a new recently appointed headmaster, Mark Semmons, and he'd clearly been appointed to reinvigorate and, you know, really write the next chapter of this amazing school. And this was clearly, you know, the COO role that would work into him to help him and the senior team do that. And so I really like the change element. I also really like, and again, this might sound a bit odd, I really like being a number two. So I spent my whole career thinking that I wanted to be in charge. And I am, as my family and my kids and my mum will tell you, I am kind of bossy. so I had this thing where I was like, I need to be in charge. And actually, when I got a role as a managing director CEO, I enjoyed it, but not as much as I thought I would. And actually, that helped me recognize that the thing I'd been kind of chasing my whole life, which is to be at the top of the pile, actually didn't fulfill me in the way that I thought it would. And so what I personally prefer is I really like being a really good number two. And again, that's a good thing. People need good number twos. We can't all be the chief exec or the Olympic medal winner or whatever. So I like that kind of, I also quite like the slightly behind the scenes nature of the role. I'm, despite appearances, I'm actually quite introverted. And so I'm a kind of sociable introvert, I suppose. So I quite like the, you know, I'll run the backstage crew and you can do the front of house and you can be the big head. I really like that. So that kind of role appealed to me. So I suppose change, number two, behind the scenes. And then the third piece was that there can be few organisations that are more about people than a school. And I suppose because of my academic background, education as a thing was something I've always been interested in. And again, I'm particularly interested in, you know, how do we create the adults of the future? That's a really fascinating journey that I suppose I've started going on as a parent. And now I have the opportunity to do that in my professional life as well.
So just in terms of, you know, a little bit of a rewind there, Emma, in terms of the number one and the number two, you know, what skills do you think are required in terms of being a number two that potentially aren't required in being number one?
I don't know if these are things that are not required for being the number one, but I think they're things that you play more as a number two. So I think to be an effective number two in any relationship, I think you have a level of humility. So quite low ego. You don't need or want to be in the limelight or making the final decision always. You're happy to be that more kind of humble or collaborative sense. I also think one of the really powerful things of being a number two, or in fact, not just a number two, but a member of a good leadership team, is that you're the check and balance. And I like that, you know, that we go, there should be some good natural tension between a chief exec and a chief operating officer, or between, you know, me and my finance director. I like that idea of, and I don't mean tension in the sense that we all fall out with each other, and that, I mean genuine tension where you go, a big part of my role is to hold other people's roles to account and them to me. And I think that's a really powerful dynamic. And I think also a big part of your job as the support crew to other people is to understand what they need. So I think the single biggest challenge in my job is to go, what do my governing body need from this role and from me? What does my head need? What do the senior leadership team need? What do the academic need? So actually I think it's perhaps one of the truest kind of servant leader roles where you go, I'm not here for me or my role. The whole point of my role is to enable other people. So that kind of skill set around understanding how can I be of service to you, I suppose, is my fundamental question in my job.
And I suppose just along those, how can you be of service to the team that you work with, Emma?
So I think there's a few things. I think, and again, this perhaps is specific to this context, but the team here wanted change and difference. So they wanted a more commercial voice in the room. So I think about that a lot. And it doesn't mean that my more commercial voice is always right, because quite often it isn't. But they wanted that voice and that experience. They wanted a voice and experience around people and culture. And I think they wanted, and they still want, that kind of energy to change things, but in a way that's respectful of what's here already. I think one of the real challenges in my current role is driving change in an organization, and not just Repton. I think most large independent schools are inherently traditional, hierarchical, and so on. And that's part of their uniqueness and their USP, and that's why they're really great. And that's a really interesting culture to drive change in, because you have to try, and again, I don't always get this right, you have to do it in a way that's respectful to something that's been here for 500, 1,000 years and done very well without you. And that always makes me remember one of the first people I ever worked for at Screwfix, brilliant woman who I still admire and speak to a lot. And I was at the early stage of my career when you're like super enthusiastic and your work is everything. And I was really stressed about whatever it was I was doing. She pulled me into her office and she sat me down. She's like, "And here's what you need to know." And I was like, "This will be interesting." She's like, "What you need to know, you know, your passion for your work and everything is brilliant. And that's really good." But she said, "One day you're going to leave here and no one is going to build a statue to you in reception." And I was like, "Are you sure? They might."
Disappointing.
But it's you know, that's 20 something. It stuck with me because it kind of anchors and grounds me in that humility of, I will come here, I will do a brilliant job. At some point, I won't be here, and somebody else will turn up and think everything I did was rubbish and change it all. And I think just having that sense of perspective is really helpful. So again, I turn up to somewhere like Repton and go, "Oh, I've got all these fantastic ideas." And rightly, you know, the organization goes, "Well, that's all very interesting, but we've done very well for 500 years without you." And I do think, you know, that just kind of anchoring yourself in that and remembering that some of your fantastic ideas might actually be rubbish or not right for the context that you're in, or might need to be delivered in a particular way or take much longer than you think they should. I think that's a good thing to remember. I remain hopeful that there might one day be.
I was going to say.
And actually, to be fair, in a school, that's the one place where you might well end up with your name at least on a board or something. So one day I'll be able to have a glass of wine with her and tell her that she was wrong. But, you know.
I told you so.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in this idea of tension, Emma, actually, because you mentioned a couple of things. And I suppose it's the tension around change. In an organization that's quite ensconced in the traditional way of doing things. I suppose the tension that you mentioned around you working with your team. And I suppose the tension that we always speak about in education is that tension between business and education. So how do you go about, you know, I suppose, managing the tension around those three themes?
So I think the dimension around change and traditionalism, I think, is about respect to compromise fundamentally, and also often about timing and speed of pace of change. You know, if you work in a startup in San Francisco, you'll be able to execute change at a rate of knots that even me as a changey person would probably be slightly frightened by. You know, if you're trying to execute change in a 500-year-old public school, you have to recognize that there might be some things you can change, really, but there will be things that you will have to tread a careful path and do things in a way that your organizational culture can cope with. Because otherwise your change won't land and therefore you'll have wasted your time anyway. So I think that's the first piece for me. The second piece around people, so whether it's down into my team, across into my peers, up into my boss and the governor, that's all about the quality of your relationships, and it's fundamentally about trust. For me, that is about the only way that you can have positive natural tension is if you all fundamentally trust each other. And again, that's not an easy thing to achieve. And I think it also involves spending a lot of time with each other, getting to know someone as a person and really understanding in the truest sense, who are you? What drives you? What's your experience that's brought you here? And that we were doing some EDI training yesterday and reflecting on this. that because as human beings, you naturally gravitate to people who are a bit like you because it's easier, right? When you have to build those trusting relationships with people who are very different, it's really hard work. And there are times when I go, oh God, it would just be much easier if everyone here was more like me. And but actually, that's not how you get the best results. You get the best results by deliberately crafting a team of people who are different and working hard at making that difference work positively for your organization. So whilst I do, the lazy part of me goes, oh, hard work. But it's good work. And then the third piece around kind of education and business is a really interesting one. And interestingly, I think that's the area where my organization currently has actually been most open and perhaps more open than I was expecting,
okay.
Which perhaps says more about my expectations than I don't. But because I kind of came here thinking that people in education might think that business was a dirty word in some way. And that we shouldn't talk about customers or we shouldn't talk about money and the need to actually make enough. So I trod really, really carefully around things like that. But actually, there was a greater openness to that than perhaps I'd expected. I think because even before the pandemic, I think, you know, people who work in this sector are fundamentally smart, bright people. So even if they've never had a career outside of education, they recognize the challenges that this sector faces. They recognize that, you know, very few politicians of any color are particularly friendly towards us now. They recognize some of the quite existential threats to, you know, pricing yourself out of the market or, again, potentially political change that could make it very difficult for independent education to survive. So I actually think, and again, none of that's anything to do with me, that's just the context that we exist in that I think has opened the door to a conversation that is more commercial. I think some of it's about language as well. You know, so again, being respectful to the organization you work in, unless I duff it up, I try not to say, you know, making a profit because we're a charity and we don't make a profit, we make a surplus. And so I think there are really tiny things you can do to try to recognize the context that you've come into. But equally, you know, the facts are quite straightforward. We are, an independent education is a phenomenally expensive product financially. And also, not only as a parent or a customer, you're not only going to hand over a large amount of cash over the time, you're giving us your most precious thing. You're giving this school your child. And if you're giving us your child, particularly as a boarder, or even as a day pupil, because our day is so long, you know, we look after your child for longer than you do as a parent. So it's a really interesting customer relationship. And again, that's one of the things that really fascinates me about this job and this sector is that we are not just, you know, something that's expensive and that is a, you know, a considered decision for most people. We're also looking after probably the most precious thing that you have, which is your children. And there is no business or commercial job in which you would do something that fascinating and that challenging.
So how does that then, I suppose, impact the way that you do interact with the customer?
So I suppose in a direct way, I don't. And I think that's a good thing. So the only reason our customers would interact with me usually is if something's gone a bit wrong or if there's a problem somewhere. Yeah. So it tends to be at the less positive or at the problem solving end of things, shall we say. So in a sense, I think my role and a lot of what me and my teams do should be invisible to our customers. You know, in the same way that when I ran retail, I didn't want any of my customers to worry about how I was running the stock room or the technology. They just need to see it working brilliantly. And I think a school is no different. You know, my parents want to see their child have a fantastic education in this school. And therefore, that kind of direct contact, I hope, is actually quite limited because the people who really matter in the school are the academic staff and the pastoral teams who are, you know, front into the pupils and their parents. I'm now going to completely contradict myself there and say what is really important is that I understand that customer. So right. I spend time in this school. You know, so before I came on here, I was at our chapel service. I spend time with our pupils. I have lunch with them at least two or three times a week. I go to the concerts, the events. I spend time on the touchlines at the weekends with parents, not even necessarily them knowing who I am, but just so I suppose I'm, and it's been hard with the pandemic, but now things are more normal. I deliberately work really hard to be in this community and to understand the experiences that our pupils and our parents might be having, so that I can then understand behind the scenes and all the invisible stuff that we do that should just work. How do I do that really well for our families? So I suppose I think about how I create a really frictionless customer experience. And actually, I think about three customer groups. I think about our parents and guardians and families. You know, I think about our pupils. And then I think about our academic and pastoral staff. So they're my kind of three key groups of customers. And I suppose the role for me and all of my teams is to go, how do I make Repton the best possible experience I can for those three key groups of customer?
That's really, really, really interesting, isn't it? But there's three groups of customers. So how do you make the best customer experience for those three different groups?
So I think it's about, as I said, knowing and understanding your customer as much as you can. So trying not to make assumptions about what teachers want or what parents want. So actually living it and breathing it, talking to them and asking them. I think it's also about being realistic, you know, because if you go to any organisation and go to your staff, whether they're teachers or not, and go, what would you like? Everybody usually says, we'd all like to be paid more. We'd all like to work less hours. And I, you know, and I'm like, so I think you have to be honest and realistic as well about what you can reasonably achieve. And back to the point around business, in the last couple of years, I've done a lot more with our whole staff about helping people understand high level the financials of a school, so that they understand what sits behind some of the decisions that we have to make. Because again, people can only manage and understand with the information they have available. And if you hide all of that from them, then, you know, a teacher going, well, why can't we have this refurbished? Or why haven't we done thing X? Or why can't we do thing Y? You know, I think it's important to explain why sometimes we can't do thing X, or we can, but in 2 years' time, or you can, but we can only afford to do A or B, which would you prefer? So I think having a level of honesty with people as well. And again, I think in respect of parents, that's very true as well. You know, we need to be honest and realistic about, you know, how much it will cost to put your child through a school like this. But we can also be honest about, you know, here are the routes where you can be supported if you need to. You know, again, schools are rightly open and honest about, here's the rules. And if your kid breaks the rules, there'll be a sanction. And I think that level of having an adult-to-adult relationship with our customers is really important. And then I think the third piece, again, is kind of always having an eye to the future. So who is, you know, whoever our customer was 20 years ago, are they still the same customer now? Do they still have the same needs and wants? And then if you play that forwards, because again, schools, in my very limited experience so far, or maybe this school, you know, it takes a long time to change things. And it also takes a long time to, you know, build and create things. So you need to have a very long-term view of the development that might be required in your organization. So we've just done a piece of work around going, right, what's the customer perception and expectation going to be in 20 years' time? And again, we don't know, so we're just going to have to guess and document some assumptions and see what happens. But if you can take that view, then you can start now going, so what do we need to be doing now to gradually build towards that? So again, I suppose trying to understand how your customer might change over time is also really important. You know, and as a school, I think we do a lot formally and informally to engage, you know, pupil voice, parent voice, staff voice. And again, behind the scenes, I'm quite a data geeky person. So again, all of that kind of richness of qualitative and quantitative feedback, I find essential to then be able to design services that deliver to those needs.
So there's two things that stuck out for me. First one is around sharing, I suppose, financials with staff, with teaching staff. which, again, in my prior experience, doesn't always happen, or if it does happen, can be quite crude. So I suppose just centering on that for a minute, how did you go about doing that, and what kind of information did you relay to people?
So there's kind of three different strands, I suppose. So first of all, in the senior leadership team, I think you can, again, it kind of predicates itself upon, you know, do we all trust one another and so on, which I go, let's assume we do, because we're all a leadership team working together. That, I think, you can share a reasonable level of detail. Because, again, the reason I'm sharing it is so that we make better decisions. And if you are the deputy head academic or the deputy head pastoral, and if you're trying to make a decision about thing X or Y, and you don't truly understand the financial levers, then I haven't done a very good job of giving you the information you need to make the right decision. So I think at that level, and quite often that's, you know, in one-to-one sessions, and again, I won't take all the credit here, a lot of the legwork on this is my finance director and her team. So it tends to be, you know, working sessions or conversations about what is it we want to do, and therefore what financials do you need to help make this decision. You know, when I first came here, we did termly accounts. Now, again, nothing wrong with that. In a school, works termly, that's fine. But as a commercial person, I go, how can I make sensible, in-the-moment financial decisions if the last time I knew where we were against our budget was, you know, a term and a bit ago by the time we've crunched all the numbers? I need something every month so I can see. So we switched to just doing monthly accounts, so we have a much more regular view on how is this organization performing, and that enables us to be more agile and I think to have better quality in our decision making. So I think that's piece one, at kind of that senior level, quite detailed, but only the things people need to know to make the decisions about their bit. Again, because I think some of our staff and the culture generally finds this approach different and frightening. So you can't just go, oh, look, everybody have everything. And
let's spreadsheet.
Let's do a big spreadsheet. Let's put on the wall who earns what. You know, no, this is no terrible idea. But at that senior level, we share quite a lot in confidence and in one-to-one sessions. For the staff more broadly, it tends to be very high. Again, what do our staff more broadly need to understand? I think, first of all, they need to understand that we are, you know, financially strong and stable, which we are. But again, I don't think you should assume that people will know that. You know, you might need to tell them. And I think it's helpful. Again, I'm a big fan of the kind of Gallup 12 employee engagement sort of approaches, where I go, people in any organization, and I don't believe schools are any different, perform better if they understand the context in which they're operating and they understand how whatever bit they do contributes to the whole. So again, in the spirit of that, I think we share a level of high level financials. And again, all this information is in the public domain. It's all on Companies House. So that the thing I find odd is that people think it's odd to share this information when I go, but it's on a website that anybody could go and look at. You just haven't. So we you know, we're careful and selective and respectful in what we share. And we try to share the right amount of information to the right people to be helpful to them. You know, so if I'm one of our domestic teams in a boarding house, I don't need to know the ins and outs of the P&L, and I probably rightly don't care, but I do need to know that this is a stable place for me to work. I need to know that the quality of leadership is good and that people are making good decisions for the future. So, you know, and I might want to know that the organization is growing and developing, because if I was interested in developing my career. So I kind of think about that. I think about what level of financial information is useful and helpful to people.
I suppose the second question, in terms of the discussions that you said that you're having, Emma, is in 20 years time, what you think your customers will look like. So, you know, do you have any pearls of wisdom in terms of, I suppose, insight into what you're talking about in 20 years time, or how you're planning for that?
No, so again, I should probably say, no, I don't, because I'd be lying if I said I did. Again, because I think fundamentally you can't know. But what you can do is you can document a set of assumptions that you can work towards and check in on them regularly. And then what I think you have to do, because you can't know the future of your customer, you have to create an organization that is flexible.
Right.
So there's this weird kind of balancing act between being really planned and organized, but also being highly flexible. And actually, I think that's where some of my retail and e-commerce experience is helpful, because retail, because it's about thousands of people and shops and physical infrastructure and so on, works on that quite kind of, you have to usually be pretty planned and organized to get everything lined up. E-commerce is much more agile because it's fundamentally digital. You can develop it differently. You can change, you can test, you can learn. And so I think those two parts of my experience come together helpfully in the same way for thinking about a school. And yeah, again, I think you, when you design or build something for a school, whether it's a service or a physical piece of infrastructure, what we're now trying to do is not build it for now. We're trying to build it for what could happen in the future. So let me give you, I mean, this is the world's tiniest example, but again, I think all big decisions are made up of little tiny ones. We're thinking about boarding accommodation of the future. Right. And we're thinking about developing a particular boarding house. And actually, again, not my idea. My facilities director said, when we refurb that one, can we make the laundry facilities in that boarding house just bigger? I was like, yeah, we probably could. Why? Because he said, because at the moment, our current model is that we do laundry in each individual house and so on, which is good. We like that. It's part of our USP that everything is in your house. But he said, what we haven't got is any contingency for if, you know, a laundry goes down, either all the machines break or all the people are ill or whatever. So we've got no flex in that model. Yeah. Whereas if when we built a new house or refurbished one, we had a laundry that was bigger and configured differently, that would mean that if we wanted to, we could change our model or we could run it differently, or we could manage a disaster situation. So it's those kinds of pieces of, and again, that, like I said, that feels like the world's smallest and worst example of
that's a good example to give, though.
Laundry. But, you know, it's that sort of thinking, I suppose, where you just go, how do you build in? And I think the pandemic has also made us really think about that. You know, we had, before the pandemic, all of our technology was on-prem. As it happened, I turned up and went, that's quite risky in its own right. And we'd managed to change it before the pandemic. But again, if you've got a load of on-prem technology, you're then going to really struggle to deliver things if you get a pandemic, or not just a pandemic, anything else that physically closed your site. If you now can't access your systems remotely, or you're in trouble. So I think a big part of our strategic thinking for the future is around agility and flexibility, because you do not know and you cannot predict what your customer of the future will be. The best you can do is think about that and try to make some assumptions. And again, ask your current customers, or look at, again, data sets and trends over time. So that's how I would try to answer that question.
It's really interesting, because a lot of the things that we're talking about here, it is about that agility piece, isn't it? I mean, if you think, again, as you mentioned, Emma, you've got a very, you know, an old traditional school, and then there's the change within that. And then you've got the managing those conversations with different people, having those robust conversations. You mentioned a little bit of the agility, the tension between business and then education and all these different things. Then the customers and how you interact with them. And then also then planning for the future. There's a lot of, I suppose, agility and relationship building and the ambiguity and a lot of those things, I would think.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ambiguity, and I think you have to, as any leader, you have to be comfortable with the level of ambiguity. And again, but again, it's quite different, because actually in the pupil-facing part of the school, because it's children, there's not that much ambiguity. There's lots of structure and there's rules. And and again, I think that's an interesting dynamic that, you know, in my areas or behind the scenes or in operations, there's always ambiguity and chaos. And again, that's why we try and hide it all, because that's the nature of the kinds of things that I do. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, actually. But that in itself is also an interesting dimension, that you kind of have this organisation of two halves. And again, lots of people I've spoken to in this sector, you know, talk about the kind of divide between the support staff and the academic staff and so on, and how we need to overcome it. And I do think we should, because we're all a single community, and whatever we do, we're all just trying to deliver the best we can for our pupils and for, you know, young people, and to care for them and safeguard them and look after them. But also in some ways, I don't mind that there's a bit of a, I don't like the word divide, but difference. There's nothing wrong with difference. In fact, there's lots of good things in an organization about difference. I think as long as we have cohesion of purpose and cohesion of fundamental values or behaviors, how, you know, I think we do need to be aligned about how we do things. You know, are we polite and respectful? Are we openly very challenging? You know, how do we do things? I think you need the level of alignment around. But actually then the what we do and it can be very different. You know, if you work in this school as a member of my maintenance team, you might need and want different things from this organization than if you're here as a head of maths. Yeah. And again, I'm like, that's okay and that's good. And I think, again, as a, what if we can, as a good employer, we try to be as many things to as many people as possible.
It's really interesting you say that, because, you know, the work that I do with schools in lots of different contexts around these coaching culture wars that we've launched, it is about that. It's about what is the cohesion that we're looking for? Because there's a plurality of different roles, support staff, students, parents, whatever it is. But what are some of those key themes that how we want to interact, how we want to talk, how we want to set things up, and purpose and values and culture comes into that. And then once you've got that set and everyone's aligned to that, as you said, Emma, then you can have that difference and people can specialize in the way that they need to make sure that the school's going the direction that it needs to go in.
Yeah, agreed. And I think you're that kind of, again, it's that, where does cohesion help us to be better, and where does plurality help us to be better?
I always just
try to think about, we're always just trying to be better versions of ourselves, a better version of the school, an even better version of our organization, whatever. So I try just to step back and ask those kinds of questions about what will help us to do that. Again, we were chatting about this yesterday about situational leadership. And about, you know, there are occasions where somebody needs to turn up and go, we are doing this, get on with it. You know, even the classic, you know, the army general, because if we all have a chat about it, we're going to die in the meantime. And then there are other occasions where you really need to step back and, you know, consult widely and really consider. And then there's other different styles in between. And I think they flex according to both the people or person and the situation. Yes, you'll sense from all the many things I read, again, leadership and how do you make organisations effective is another area that I've always been fascinated by. Again, I don't pretend to be any good at it. I'm always just learning and trying to be better than I was yesterday. But yeah, I'm fascinated about how you design organisations, how they behave, how culture is created. You know, people are always, throughout my career, people have always, you know, they say things like, oh, well, this organization or this company decided something or did something or feel. And you're like, but what is this organized? This or, you know, this organization isn't a thing. It is a collection of individual people who make it a thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I find all of that, again, your sense, just really interesting.
What are you reading at the moment?
I've just finished reading, this is on a completely different topic. I've just finished reading a really interesting book called, is it Sexy Butt Psycho? Sexy Butt Psycho. Yes, which is...
Say that again, Emma.
Sexy Butt Psycho. Okay, so actually this is a book about, it's nothing to do with education at all, this one. This is about how women are routinely pathologized when they've been abused. And I read it because... as part of the work I'm doing on myself around diversity and inclusion, I decided for once to harness the power of social media instead of getting a bit annoyed by it. So I started deliberately following some very different people on Instagram who are not like me in all sorts of different dimensions. And again, I confess, I find it quite hard. You know, some of it I read and I'm like, oh, I don't even understand what this one's about. But I go, well, at least I'm trying. And as part of that, I think I connected with a friend of mine who's a feminist writer, and she was connected to someone else who was connected to this lady called Dr. Jess Taylor, who has written this book. And I just saw a post on Instagram and thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll read that. So I've just finished reading that. And then on the flip side, I've also just read a brilliant book that now I can't remember either the name or the author, but it's by a man who was sent to prison for fraud. And so, you know, a sort of, I think he was actually a journalist, or, you know, so white middle class, white collar chap who ends up in Wandsworth prison for the best part of 2 years. And it's a fascinating book. And actually then he has a podcast off the back of it. And again, that's, I was just interested because I'm interested in whether sending people to prison actually makes any difference, or, you know, again, I find this fascinating. And then what was really interesting about his story as well is that his podcast is now stories from lots of the other people who he met in prison.
Right.
And all of them are interesting, fascinating people. Again, some of them have done some truly terrible things, but there's, again, a really interesting dichotomy around everyone is a person and has some kind of story or context that I, again, I think is, you know, everyone's story has value and can probably teach us all something, even if parts of their story or their actions are truly horrific. So there we go. So sorry, again, I probably should have thought about that. I've read these really interesting books about education. So I've been reading about, feminist women's abuse issues and about men being sent to prison.
Well, it sounds really interesting, Emma.
Yeah, really cheery reading, right? I should say that further along here, there is a whole section of like trashy chit lit. As well, when I'm on a sun lounge or somewhere, I like trash, and I love a Netflix, you know, binge as well.
So. Yeah. When are you next going to be on a sun lounge, do you think?
Oh, I don't know, because we're actually quite dull as a family. We quite like to travel in the UK, because again, I think this is a brilliant country. There's loads of interesting places. I've probably only lived or worked or visited 20% of this country. We also have dogs that my husband doesn't like to put in kennels, so that's a somewhat restricting factor for going abroad. And we're also all very pale and ginger, so, hot sun usually doesn't work for us anyway. But I'm hoping that over the summer we might sneak a week in. I don't know, I was thinking maybe, actually not a sun lounger, I was thinking maybe a city break. Okay. So like a Barcelona or Paris. My daughter is 6 and she's actually never been on an aeroplane. So she just really wants to go on an aeroplane. So we could probably just go to like Glasgow or something just so that she can go on an aeroplane. And then she also thinks it sounds very glamorous to stay in a hotel. So I'm thinking, you know, aeroplane and hotel, we could either go to Barbados or something, or we could just go to a Premier Inn in Glasgow. And
yeah. Hey, don't mock the Premier Inns in Glasgow.
Exactly. No. I think that's what I quite like as well about being in a school around, especially when I work at the prep school with our younger kids. Mm. Their view of the world is just brilliant. You know, so again, often as an adult, you think, oh, holiday, you know, we must keep up with the Joneses and go on some super glamorous thing. Speak to a small kid and they're like, oh, we could go to, the Premier Inn in Glasgow, and that'll be because it'll be, oh, there's all you can eat breakfast and we can go on an aeroplane. And again, I love that kind of energy and curiosity for the world that's totally, or at that age, it's just really unfiltered and you haven't yet become jaded by the world around you. So I find, I think if I'm having a tough week for any reason, I go and have lunch with like year one or reception or something like that. Because again, I find particularly those really young children just totally changes your perspective. I had lunch the other week with a little lad who they obviously all the kids ask what I teach. And then after it's been, I don't teach, I do other things at the school. And he was only in, I think, year two. And he listened to what I said about what I did. And he said, are you the clock lady? I guess I am actually. Yes, clocks, you know, it states an infrastructure. So I said, yes, I suppose I do. You know, in my teens, we do look after the clocks at the school. And then he started telling me all about his favourite clock, which is the one on top of the music building. And again, this is brilliant. Then his friend next to him pipes up about, do you also do the fire alarm? And I'm like, yeah, I guess I do. And he's like, I love the fire alarms. But I love that. I love, you know, things that perhaps as an adult we think, oh, this is a really, that's a boring but essential part of my job. But someone who's six thinks that's really exciting. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love, I suppose, do you do the fire alarms?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. It's funny. I went away with my niece and nephews a couple of weeks ago, and we in the UK, we took them to these museums, you know, the beach. We did everything, you know. And I asked them at the end what was the best bit, and the best bit was just spending time out running around playing football. And sometimes that's just, you know, just kids, they just need that space, don't they, just to go out and just do things.
Yeah.
And I suppose the time from people, you know, they don't flashy stuff all the time. It's like, you know, clocks, alarm bells, you know, it's the little things, isn't it?
And I think, as I said, I think because I still have somewhere in me that sort of innate childlike curiosity, I'm kind of with him. I'm like,
yeah.
And then, it, you know, I walked around the rest of the day really noticing the clocks. I think there's a huge amount of wisdom in, and again, I think that's part of why I love working in a school. There is so much inherent and innate wisdom in young people that I think is really powerful. And really exciting and really invigorating.
Well, I'm going to bring the conversation to a close now. But before I do, and it's a question I ask most of the guests on the podcast, around a piece of advice that you give yourself at the start of your career.
To be honest, it's probably the piece of advice that my old boss gave me, which is always remember that, you know, what you do is really important, but probably no one's going to build a statue of you in reception. So I think really it's about keep perspective and keep that sense of purpose and keep anchoring back into what is really important in the whole of my life. I once worked with a really great coach when I was at Clark's, and he always talked about imagining the speech that someone will make, God willing, at your 80th birthday party. And when I'm, you know, feeling that kind of about something at work or in personal life, but particularly at work, I always think about, right, this thing that I'm currently really consumed by and really, you know, perhaps cross about or struggling with, is that going to feature in my 80th birthday speech? Mm. To which the answer is invariably no, unless it's a really boring and bad speech. And again, it just helps me. So it would probably be, it's that something in that dimension that kind of says, yes, have that huge passion for what you do, because that's what drives all of us and helps us turn up every day and make a difference. But just think about what's really going to matter when you stand there on your 80th birthday, or, you know, really reflect on your life. What's truly important?
That's a lovely cadence to the conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today, Emma. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedules as well.
No, thank you. It's been slightly frightening, but I've really, really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Pleasure. If you're interested in partnering with Pursue through our suite of individual team and school-wide coaching culture awards, please send me an email at hello@pursue.com or visit our website, pursue.com. You can also follow me on LinkedIn and Twitter at Nicholas McKyle Pursue. And if you enjoy the show, please leave a rating and spread the word. We are proud to have developed a truly global and collaborative community. Take care and look forward to speaking to you again soon.